The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast for two siblings who love books.
We love books. Oh, fuck.
Oh, no, we didn't write anything for this.
God damn it.
We love books so much, we fashioned a rover out of some and drove them halfway across the planet. We didn't do that.
No. If I went to Mars, my entertainment would just be like an entire library, basically. So, I guess there's that.
That's right. You can store a lot of text. You wouldn't have to reread very many things.
Yeah. That'd be pretty sweet. So, yeah, I'm Gabs.
And I'm Ben.
And this week, we have a special guest star.
Hooray!
Hooray! His name is Adam. So I want to say hey. We went to school undergrad together, and Adam is one of those people who like actually listens to the podcast. So
true.
He wanted to be a guest star.
That's right.
It's also true.
So I think by having Adam on this episode, we reduced the listening audience by like 18% or something like that.
Yeah.
No, I'll listen to my own podcast. I certainly will listen to myself.
Hey, he might be able to convince a couple extra people to listen.
Yeah, so. There you go.
Just want to say I'm a big fan. After we record, I'm going to go to Twitter and Facebook and let everyone know. So you might get a huge uptick in your traffic. Not that I'm incredibly popular, but you might get a big uptick.
All right.
Put some literally dozens of visitors.
That's right. Put some pressure on me to actually edit this one and get it posted.
Yeah. So this episode, we read The Martian by Andy Weir. The science fiction novel that is sweeping the bestseller list. As far as I know, it's still sweeping the bestseller list. I guess I don't actually know it for sure.
Up to our usual standards of research, in other words.
Yeah, it was popular like 5 months ago, so it's probably still popular.
I don't know. I met someone who was reading it once, so it's probably still a bestseller.
Yeah, and we chose this, like we said, because it was a bestseller. I think around Christmas when I was in a Barnes & Noble, it was kind of everywhere. And the big new thing about it is they are making a movie starring Matt Damon that I think is coming out later this year.
Yeah, I think it's supposed to come out November 25th, so right around the Christmas, so that bodes actually pretty well for the movie, what the studios think about it.
Yeah, so it'll probably get on the bestseller list again if it's fallen off. And we haven't done science fiction for a while, and of course, knowing Ben, like, we had to do some science fiction, so. And before we got started just talking about the book in general, one of the things that Ben and I thought would be kind of interesting to mention about this particular book is that Andy Weir, in the versions that we have, there's an author interview in the back and a little essay that he wrote about the process of writing the book. Yeah. And The Martian actually started out as a self-published work. So he was publishing one chapter at a time on his personal blog, and it just started picking up steam and eventually got him a huge book deal. So and neither one of us actually knew that this was originally self-published before we read it. I just kind of assumed it was a regular old book. And so that just brings up, you know, this good point about how the way the publishing industry is changing, how self-publishing is just becoming more and more of a viable option. I guess depending on who you are, because, you know, sometimes if you self-publish, zero people read your book. But getting popular as a self-publisher is a great way to get a book deal.
Yeah, so two things kind of struck me when I discovered that this was a self-published book. One of them was that it's a really good example of how this like new media, I guess, kind of publishing environment can really be successful for some people, and two, how this is also the perfect illustration in some ways of exactly why that is not going to happen for most people who write a book. I mean, I think the numbers, like the upside, it strikes me that maybe the upside to self-publishing is that you can, if you have like a small to mid-sized audience of readers, you can probably have a few less people read your book but still have the same financial success. So, you know, if you get 7,000 readers at $1 a download, then if you're a writer who's getting a $5,000 advance and then barely earning that out and getting some royalties, you're gonna have to have a lot more than 7,000 people buy the book probably.
Yeah, actually, if you are a successful self-publisher, the margins are much different because if you're self-publishing, you're getting, like, what, I don't know, like 70-80% royalties, depending on, like, how much of your own money you put into, like, getting it edited or whatever, or if you, like, buy a publicist. But if you go through, like, one of the big publishers, the standard royalty rate is 10%. So if you sell 5,000 copies of the book as a self-publisher, then you're making a lot more money than if you sell 5,000 copies of the through a traditional publisher. So that's like the really big upside. But the big upside to going through a traditional publisher is you're a lot more likely to have 5,000 people read your book if you have like a professional marketing team,
right,
than if you're just posting something online.
And certainly traditional publishing didn't keep people like J.K. Rowling from having a swimming pool full of cash.
Yeah. If you sell a lot, then, yeah. And royalty rates go up the more books you sell because the publishers make their money back and they can give you a little more, and all this other stuff comes into it.
And they want you to write your next book for them if you're selling that many copies, too. So that's,
yeah.
There are incentives in there.
I didn't get the same edition you guys got. I remember walking into a Barnes & Noble and I have poor impulse control when it comes to books. And I saw a book called The Martian and I liked the artwork in the front. And I was like, oh, that, you know, why not? And I got it. And it's one of those rare books, not to give too much away, that I am glad that I got the hardback edition.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's also, you know, walking into a Barnes & Noble and seeing the interesting title and the cool cover art, that's exactly what a professional marketing department does for you, right?
Yes, actually.
Hey,
not to get too much into detail.
I was
going to
say, hey, graduate student in publishing.
I will avoid giving you guys an hour-long lecture on how you get your book placed in bookstores. Yeah, so, all right. So, anything else interesting we want to say about that, or do you want to just start talking about the books?
Oh, let's talk about the actual book. unless one of your marketing people is listening right now.
Oh, no, it's fine. No one wants to actually hear about this.
That's right.
Except people in my program.
So, Like Gab said at the top, this is science fiction. A little more specifically, it's in the hard science fiction category, which basically means that the author actually acknowledges that there's math involved. That's a pretty good rule of thumb for defining what makes it hard as opposed to just fantasy-type science fiction, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah. One of the things that struck me when I first started reading this book is that right away, so, you know, like, whereas if I was almost dead trapped on Mars, I would probably just spend a week straight, like, crying. He's like, right away, he's like, all right, I got to figure out how I'm going to survive here. And, like, I thought it was interesting that the book kind of starts out with him being like, oh, I have some potato seeds. I can make potatoes. And then he sits down and figures out, like, how many square feet of soil he can make to grow however many potatoes to last him however many calories a day. And I was like, okay, this is hard sci-fi because
yeah.
That's a lot. I mean, that is calculations you would actually have to do, you know, if you were trying to survive that many days. But that's not something you see in most science fiction.
Yeah, it spoke to how realistic it was, like you said. And then these are the calculations that NASA thinks about. And then when we watch other science fiction, Star Wars, Star Trek, it's either just ignored. You almost never see people eating in Star Trek or Star Wars. And in Star Trek, it's so far in the future, they can just go, you know, it's a replicator and food is here, move on. This is hard science fiction, and these are the calculations that NASA makes and NASA figures out.
That is one of the cool things, reading books like this or watching, it's like when I was reading this book, it made me think of Apollo 13, because that's like another classic NASA has to like figure out how to get these people home. Sort of thing, but I was just really impressed by like all of the shit that they take into account and the solutions they come up with. So that's like one of the cool things about hard science fiction, if you're not just sitting there like, duh, so much technical stuff, which I did on occasion while reading, but then when you think about it, you're like, no, it's really, like, really, really cool how, like, if someone actually bothered to figure that out, so.
Yeah, I guess for me, that was one of the more endearing parts of the book, because that's NASA's, I guess, calling card is just ingenious and creativity. A lot of the problems a lot of the things they try and do, you know, absolutely no one has ever realistically tried to do before. So they have to overcome problems that they never anticipated and invent so many things and technologies that we still use today. You know, the most obvious probably is Tang to getting someone to drink in space. They invent, I think, Velcro also. Is this something that for granted? They're like, we don't have any quick fasteners. What do we do? It's like, okay, some guy was like, oh, I, you know, I have this hook and loop system that's kind of miniaturized, and that makes a really strong connection. Like, oh, Velcro. You know, so on and so forth. It speaks to NASA's, I guess, core ethos, is that they just kind of overcome problems that you never anticipated.
Ben, I'm thinking that we should rewrite our plot synopsis to just be, fuck yeah, NASA.
I'd pull with that.
What we originally came up with.
All right, so the official plot synopsis is now, fuck yeah, NASA. Props to the boy geniuses out at Cape Canaveral.
Hey, girls too.
Absolutely.
And the girl geniuses, yes.
Come on. And then, as far as genre goes, one of the interesting points that Adam brought up, actually, while we were doing the outline, is I was originally just thinking of this book as science fiction, but he was comparing it to, you know, the classic, like, Shipwreck story, for example, or getting it abandoned somewhere on Earth, that like person versus wild sort of narrative. And I thought that brought up a great point that in addition to being science fiction, this is actually like a survival story, a man versus wild sort of thing.
Yeah, we were comparing it to like a Shipwreck Castaway type of situation, and how the environment, the setting of this book really changes some of the flavor of that kind of story, because, you know, like if you have your person who's shipwrecked on an island, at some point they're always, you know, they come up with their ingenious ways to survive, but they always luck into a couple of them. They're, oh man, I haven't had water for a couple of days, and then they realize that every morning there's water condensing on the leaves, and so they set up a bunch of leaves for the water to condense on, and they can collect water. Whereas in this story, every single thing that he needs to survive, he has to put forethought into, because guess what? On Mars, doesn't fucking rain.
Mars climatic. Oh, were you going to say gaps?
Oh, I was going to say, if it did rain on Mars, you probably couldn't drink it.
It would probably rain carbon dioxide or something.
Poisonous, but you have to remember, you know, like I said, in most science fiction, the most basics of survival, eating, breathing, and drinking, are taken care of by advanced technology and things we just kind of take for granted. Oh, in this story, Mars climatically is a desert. And it ranges, I did the research, it ranges in temperatures between like negative 81 degrees Fahrenheit to 94 degrees Fahrenheit. Now that is, 94 degrees is the absolute hottest it's going to get on that planet. So the average temperature is, I think, around 5 degrees Fahrenheit. That's brutally cold. And because of the atmosphere and the lack of a spinning iron ore core, there's so many things that he had to overcome and NASA would have to overcome. Just do the basic things of communicate, to grow food, to make water, make sure it didn't boil off immediately, because the atmospheric pressure, water will just turn to vapor.
Or what percentage of the energy resources were going just to keeping the air warm enough to not freeze to death.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it's kind of like the extreme version of that, since Mars is a little more inhospitable than most places on Earth. Does make me wonder what Bear Grylls would do if he was stuck on Mars.
Bear Grylls would die because he's not an astronaut.
He'd be like, I'll pee on this thing and then I'll have fun.
Yeah, he's like, I'll drink my own pee. Where did it go? Like, how many of these rocks did I...
There are no animals for you to tackle and kill with your knife, man.
Oh, good. Abort. I guess we've basically already described the summary of this book. So if you haven't read it, it's just a dude trying to survive on Mars. It's basically all you need to know. It's not that complicated. And so the book takes place mostly on Mars. I think over half of it's on Mars. And I guess this is like a mild spoiler alert that some of it also takes place on Earth. Because when you start reading, you're not 100% sure if it's going to be like entirely journal entries or not. So Mars is really, like almost a character in and of itself, which we'll talk about. But when we think about point of view for this book, I realized, talking to Ben, that most of the books we read are usually from a certain point of view, and this one manages to bring in three different points of view, which is essentially all the points of views that books are written from, which I think is actually really interesting. So we have these like first person diary entries / like logs from on Mars talking like what he's doing to try not to die. And then on Earth, you have these like third person kind of close points of view where you're kind of following around like a NASA administrator or someone who's like working for NASA in some capacity and like what they're doing and thinking, who they're talking to. And then we kind of have this third person omniscient, which whenever it popped up, I would go like, oh fuck, something bad's about to happen. because that point of view is used solely to help the reader know like what was going on that the characters didn't know. So like, for example, they try shooting off this like big like food ration pod essentially to Mars to give Mark some more food and buy him some more time. And the launch sequence is entirely described in like third person omniscient, where it's like, oh, you know, this happened, the food liquefied because of gravity, and then it slammed against this bolt, which ended up being partially defective, and that went, and then and so you just get like, whenever something really bad's about to happen, you get this third person omniscient narrator telling you like the exact series of events that happens to make a bad thing happen.
Hey, not to skip ahead, but I just thought of a question.
Yeah.
What sounds less appetizing to eat for 400 days? Freeze-dried potatoes or liquefied protein sludge?
I think by the end of the book, Mark would have chosen the sludge, because one of the funniest parts of the book were him talking about potatoes and how much he hated them.
Man, I love potatoes, but that love of potatoes assumes that there'll be things like butter involved.
Yeah, that's just like eating a potato. I definitely ate potato the night I finished reading this book.
A like a loaded baked potato. Mark would have killed for one. Poor guy.
A little bacon, he'd be happy.
That's right.
That should have really been the real end of the book when he gets back on the ship and they're like, all we have for you to eat are potatoes. Like, no.
I guess if it's not already obvious, Mark Watney is in fact the protagonist of this book.
Yes.
He's the character who gets all of the first person stuff, as Gabs mentioned earlier. And so, you know, Mark is, well, he's a pretty resourceful guy. Astronauts, I think, tend to be anyway, but he was given a background in mechanical engineering, so he's a dude who can basically fix anything, which is handy if you are using equipment that's meant to last for a month and trying to use it to survive for a year and a half.
Yeah.
And he's also a botanist, so he knows how to, like, grow a ton of potatoes.
Which was actually one of the more interesting little technical asides in the book, is him having to figure out how to prep the soil so it would actually be able to grow things, because that's not something that I ever would have thought of. I'd be like, oh yeah, if you just surround Martian soil with some atmosphere, you can drop some seeds in there and it's good to go, right?
Yeah.
Oh no, yeah, like bacteria nutrients are important too, right?
Yeah, I thought it was extremely fortuitous that, you know, his skill set, it was never, I don't know, it never something, I thought that was very realistic, that his, what he was able to do was all in the realm of possibility for a person with his training and education. The botany, the mechanical engineering, the mathematics he had to do. I remember later in the book, he invented a unit of measurement, I think he called it Pirate Ninja.
Pirate Ninja? Yeah.
When he calculated the amount of energy per day, and he instead of writing kilowatt per hour per soul, I'm going to call it Pirate Ninja. And for the next three pages, he casually mentioned it as Pirate Ninja.
Yeah, he really stuck to that.
Yeah, he was, like, using legitimate, mathematical equations, and he's just like, so I'll need five pirate ninjas to generate this much, and I think that's kind of interesting, Adam, that you were saying, like, it seems kind of fortuitous that he has, like, that specific background, because I did wonder at one point, like, if anyone else in the crew had been in his position, would they have been able to survive? So it's, like, the most, like, coincidental/lucky part of the book that is that he has, like, this super handy background. And then after that, then you'll just shit on him for 300 pages.
And so the other, I mean, we were just touching on that. So not only is he resourceful, but obviously if he's taking some awkward double unit conversion, that's a mouthful to say, and calling it a pirate ninja. He's also a guy who has a little bit of a sense of humor, and maybe even considering that he's stranded on a hostile planet where exposure to the natural conditions of that world for more than a couple of seconds would literally kill you, maybe even a little bit of an unusual sense of humor for being able to keep it up so consistently.
Yeah, so this is one thing, aspect of Mark, that I think is interesting. I appreciated his sense of humor most of the time. Mostly when he had people to bounce off of, when, like, a humorless NASA person was like, hey, everyone can see this, be serious. And he's like, look, boobies! Like, types like the boobies thing on his keyboard. I really appreciated moments like that. But I noticed, like, some people who had read the book who didn't like it very much, like, online, mentions that they actually thought his sense of humor was, like, kind of grating almost, and, like, more of, like, the author being like, haha, here's a funny joke, and it didn't feel, like, very natural to them. And at times, like, I think overall, like, it felt pretty true to the character, but I did think at times I was like, would someone actually be making this joke right now, or are you just like, I just did 3 pages of technical, so now I need to like throw a joke in there? So I
that the sense of humor was one of the more natural parts, because, you know, and sometimes in high stress, people in high stressful situations, people react very differently. And he was all alone in an extremely hostile world, and that his sense of humor was not just, it was also a survival mechanism. Mark entertained himself. He had to. There was no other option. That's part of keeping him sane. He had no one to talk to for long stretches of time, and to cope with his extremely dire situation, he made jokes about it. There's also, I think we'll find out later if I didn't mention before, that, you know, I'm in the military, I'm active duty, and I have been deployed twice, and I've been in situations that weren't extremely safe, and you see people, you know, laugh in the middle of it. You see people jokes, make really inappropriate jokes, jokes that would be appalling in any other situation, people make light of. And if you read any honest soldier, sailor, marine, or airman's memoirs, they'll say the same thing. Or any survivor's memoirs, that you find humor in the weirdest places. And so I felt that was very true to the human condition, his response to be kind of snarky. And it was consistent, and his sense of humor didn't change. It was, like I said, it was very consistent.
I think that's interesting, because one of the other things that I've read about this book is a lot of people who have like worked for NASA or know people who work for NASA really like this book and think that it's really true. And so I wonder if like being in NASA or being in like the military or something like that, like just gives you a different perspective on the book. Whereas someone who it's just kind of like a normal civilian who's like never been in a super dangerous situation and just like, why would you ever do that? It's like, oh, let's like throw you off of a plane and see what you do. So I don't know. I think that's kind of interesting that like maybe it's more true to people who've like actually been, it's not that like, you know, you've ever been like trapped on Mars for a year and a half, but certainly like being deployed is more harrowing than me taking the tea to school in the morning. So,
yeah, I mean, if you read memoirs,
that's an interesting point.
I say if you read like a memoir of a military person giving their account from, say, one of the world wars, since that's something I've read about a fair amount, there is a lot of gallows humor in there. Which is definitely what Adam was referencing a moment ago. Just that idea of, you know, I'm in a bad situation and you can either laugh or you can roll over and die. What are you going to do, right? And I actually, the one thing I kind of wonder with Mark, because I think if it was me abandoned somewhere for 500 days, and let's assume that in this scenario I am resourceful instead of being a fat musician and I'm actually able to live for those 500 days, I could see my logs getting pretty snarky and, if anything, probably just more and more obnoxious and grating and self-indulgent as time went by.
Yeah, and that's something that I actually like I said, most of the time I thought the humor was fine, but that was something I kind of wanted to see, was, like, at some points, the mental breakdown there, because, like, I know they mentioned one of the reasons they picked Mark for the mission is because of, like, his resourcefulness and his sense of humor and his ability to, like, keep everyone else from going crazy. But since people are made to be around other people,
right,
like, at some point, don't you think he would have some entries, like until he kind of bounced back, where he would be, like, just going nuts? I was saying to Ben, I think, before you got on, Adam, that, you know, if all he's doing is watching television, and the television is kind of giving him, like, an illusion of having, like, human contact, so that's, like, helping him keep sane a little bit. But I was like, you know, if all I was doing is, like, watching Three's Company for months on end, like, I feel like I would start writing, like, Three's Company fan fiction, and I would start talking about the characters like they were my friends, and, like, getting really upset about, like, their situations, and getting, like, super psychologically involved, because, like, that's the only human connection that you have. And so I think, you know, like, in the interest of keeping the book going, the author didn't, like, bother delving into, like, that psychological aspect. But I think it would have been kind of interesting to get to see, like, some more of those moments where he is just like, it's been a year since I've seen a person.
Yeah.
I'm going a little crazy. Like...
Yeah, like, I'd be talking...
The Dukes of Hazzard are not my best friends.
Like, I'd be talking to that radioactive pellet like it was a person by the time I was halfway through that rover trip.
Yeah.
I would have named the rover.
Oh, yeah.
Rover been like, Steve.
All right, Sparky, keep me warm, Sparky.
Okay, so as far as, like, aside from Mark, when we were thinking of other characters in the book, there's kind of a whole host of characters, but honestly, most of them are, like, kind of the same. Andy Weir definitely was like, I'm just going to kind of give everyone, like, a same general, like, level of snark to work off of and just go from there.
Yeah.
So Ben and I were thinking one useful way to think about it, as opposed to individual characters, would be to think about how the astronauts are characterized versus how, like, the NASA ground control characters are characterized.
Yeah, so I actually suggested when we were outlining that we could refer to the cast as just Snark Tank. Because that's totally what's going on. And so, like, the crew with the astronauts, they were snarky people who were also, like, borderline insane when it came to performing some act of courage. And Vogel, you know, they tried to separate a little bit by giving him a German as his first language English syntax.
Yeah.
And Lewis,
he has to say Jean.
Right. And Lewis, they tried to separate a little bit by giving her command things a couple of times. But basically, if the whole book had been about the crew, it would have been like seven snarky clones just bouncing off each other, and one of them has a German accent.
Right. For me, the other characters did, especially in the Hermes, and back at NASA, they all kind of had this general level of kind of smart-ass sense of humor, and it was funny, and it was funny to read and watch them, at least my mind's eye, bounce off each other. But I, aside from Vogel, Lewis, the mission lead on NASA, I can't pronounce his name. It's Indian. Venkat Kapoor, I think.
I wonder if it's like Wingcat, because they don't really say. I don't know.
Either way,
I got nothing.
Those are the only characters that. And I think it was named Mindy.
Yeah.
PR person. She was funny, and the woman watching him. I know that sounds like a lot of characters to the listeners, but in the book there was many more. Those are the only ones that kind of stuck out to me.
Yeah, I mean, the ground control folks, there were kind of the administrators who basically they worried about stuff. Actually, the administrators were maybe the only ones who weren't snarky most of the time.
Yeah.
They were kind of stressed out. It felt like they were just stressed out constantly. And then you had your, like, ground control geek squad, the woman who was, like, a satellite expert and the guy who was calculating orbitals, and they were a bunch of, like, socially awkward weirdos who said funny things because they didn't know better. It seemed to be more or less that archetype.
Yeah, and so I guess with the ground control, you kind of had the opposite of, like, the administrators who are too cautious, and then the other people who are, and then, like, the astronauts who are too reckless.
Right.
And then they're, like, trying to figure, like, out a happy medium between the two.
Right.
I thought the characterization was dead on. The administrators, I mean, they may care about Mark, but they care about the whole picture. And losing Mark is bad, but they, in their mind, they've already lost Mark. Losing the Hermes, what was it? The Hermes was the name of their ship?
Yeah, yeah.
And losing those other five people was completely unacceptable. And, you know, every time NASA screws up, it looks bad. And that's from their perspective. And from the Hermes and the astronaut teams, I think their team was Ares 3. From their perspective, they were willing to die and to risk their lives to save a person that they could have only cared about. You spend 10 months with a person. Again, the reference, I'm not trying to shoehorn my military experience in here, I promise. But you spend that much time with somebody, you grow extremely close. And I could definitely understand willing to risk life and limb to save somebody. And you know, not to jump too far ahead, but in the end of the book, there's arguments about that. You know, like, well, I don't care. I don't care what the orders are. I'm going to do this because I want to save Mark.
Yeah, and since, I mean, we're already talking about it a little bit, we can step back if we need to in a second. But, you know, the big, I guess, moral question of the book is it worth risking the lives of the whole crew to go back and save one guy, Mark? And the administrators decide that, no, it's not, but a dissenter... manages to get a message to the crew, and of course they're astronauts and they're already half crazy for being in space in the first place, so they say, hell yeah, let's go back and get him. And you know, going back to these military memoirs again, there are certainly no shortage of stories where six people get shot trying to drag some guy back to safety.
Right.
So, what do you guys think?
Well,
do you think it's worth the risk to try to go get Mark?
Yes, you can't leave somebody behind. I could never survive the guilt of leaving someone I cared about behind. I know for a fact, I'd move heaven and earth to save somebody I cared about, especially in that situation. It's hard to describe without sounding crazy, but you get this sense of, it doesn't, you know, my life is important, but my life isn't as important as the person next to me's life and everyone else's life. I'd be willing to hurt, or maybe even, not necessarily willing to die, but willing to put myself in extreme danger to save somebody else.
See, now that's interesting, because I think if I was a member of that crew, I would probably be gung-ho to go back and pull this guy off the planet, whatever the extra time and cost was to myself. But I think if I was in the administrative position, that the right decision is to not risk the extra lives when you're distant from it. It's a lot easier to say that, because my inclination is to save six people instead of risk six people to save one. Just like the administrators wanted to do.
That's what I was thinking too. Like in that position as an administrator, I think it totally makes sense. And I was also kind of trying to think of it as like, you know, because it was like the whole world is watching sort of thing. So I was also kind of trying to think of it on this like global level. And like, I think if you get Mark back, like the global morale is gonna like go up so much, because people get like so invested in that stuff, that's awesome. But then like, if you go on this big publicized mission and everyone dies, like what does that do to the public psyche? But I think if I was just like a bystander, so if like I was just me and this was happening and I was like watching the news all the time, like I would want them to go back and get Mark, just like on a human level.
Yeah, like if you're a casual viewer of that CNN show, the Mark Watney Watch or whatever it was called.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of a snide or like a passing glare, throw a little shade at CNN, but just having them devote an entire show to Mark Watney. I think also as an administrator, you have to consider the flat out recruitment. I mean, one of the reasons why NASA, what was that movie, Apollo 13?
Yeah.
One of the reasons, one of the unsaid reasons why they would risk their lives to go get somebody in that situation is, you know, if you're thinking about joining NASA and you know that they're willing to let you die if the math doesn't work out, how willing are you to join?
That's
an interesting point.
Yeah, that's a fair point. But like, there's a logical, I guess, cost-benefit reason to do the No Man Left Behind thing, right?
Right. How chilling would it be for you to call like, hey, Mark, we did the math, but it's going to cost too much to come get you, so we're going to let you slowly starve to death and freeze to death on Mars. You'll go down in history, but you'll never see anyone you love again. Good luck.
Have fun with that.
Like, how awful would that be to hear? Even if you weren't Mark, like, how inhuman would that sound right out of your mouth?
I could almost imagine like a parody of this kind of story where they said, okay, we're going to come rescue you, but then the story is actually about after when he gets back to Earth and they bill him for it.
So your insurance covered lies.
So all ULSs. So you're only on the hook for
next. Taxes go up.
You're only on the hook for $82 billion.
You personally owe the People's Republic of China $7 billion. Good luck, yeah, man. Hope your book deal works out. Because never have money ever again.
You're getting a lot of harassing phone calls.
Or just like if they raised everyone's taxes, like in the U.S., like, you know, 2% or whatever, and then everyone's like, suck NASA! Back to the sun on Mars!
Yeah, yeah. People like grocery store, people like throwing stuff at him, like, fuck that guy, it cost me, I can't afford cantaloupe because you had to live. Who told you to go to Mars, asshole?
The sequel to The Martian is just a very bleak commentary on our tax system.
Mark Watney.
I think that'd be kind of awesome, guys.
Mark Watney, tax protester whipping boy.
Right.
The Tea Party is like, this is the reason, guys. Awesome. So, okay, so I guess as far as, like, that was kind of the big moral issue that we talked about, and just because, like, I kind of have to bring up the feminism thing, like, every book, just to, like, give a nod to it, since, you know, it's kind of my jam. For this book, I just kind of wanted to say that there isn't really, like, anything to worry about as far as portrayals of gender go, because as far as characters are, they're basically split down the half, down the middle, excuse me. And because all the characters are basically the same, and they all do stuff, like the commander of the astronauts, Commander Lewis, is a woman. And then back on Earth, there are a couple of, like, women in higher profile roles. But, like, you never really worry about the fact, like, oh, this is a woman doing this. He's just kind of like, oh, yeah, there's her, and then there's him, and then they're all running around. And, like, so I actually liked that aspect of this book that, they're just kind of like half guys, half girls. They were doing their thing, and it wasn't really a big deal. And he even, like, bothered to say, you know, like, oh, here's an Indian guy. And I think Mindy, the girl who, like, watched the satellites, I'm pretty sure she was Asian. I think her last name was, like...
Yeah, I think you're right.
I think it was Asian.
Something.
Yeah, I think she was Vietnamese.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting that, you know, all the satellite... I don't think her name was Mindy. I'm going to look that up real quick while I talk about this, but that's a very technical job, and a job that a lot of, you know, might stereotypically not be staffed or allowed. You know what I mean? Like, there was Lewis. She was in charge. There was the PR director who kind of had this sort of, what's his name from, I can't think of it, but like kind of very by the book, business oriented. She really didn't care about the astronauts necessarily. She had a job to do. She was, I can't think of the guy's name from the '80s movie.
She's the person who, after your interview, you're like, how did I do? And she's like, you shouldn't have used this specific wording in that one sentence.
Right.
There was a satellite.
Like, oh, PR people.
Right. Mindy Park was the,
Yeah. So she's probably Korean.
Yeah, either way, but there was a broad spectrum of women doing different jobs, and it was never an issue. There was never a moment where any of the characters had to overcome anything that would, you know, a woman might encounter in that position. Maybe Andy Weir, I'm sorry, is very optimistic about gender relations in the future.
Yeah, but, I mean, like, you know, speaking as someone who's, like, looking out for gender roles all the time, like me, that's actually, this book is almost like my ideal version of it. Like, I didn't, you know, like, I wish the characterization would have been a little deeper, but, like, if every book I read was just kind of like, split down the middle, men, women, each one of them are doing their thing, and, like, it never really comes up as a huge issue. Like, isn't that, yeah, like, the ideal world that we want to live in, where it's, like,
right.
not something we have to worry about, so I appreciate that. So, yay!
Yeah. I was gonna say, it's an issue that we're discussing purely because it's a contrast, because it's a non-issue. And so really the issue that you're discussing is fiction as a whole rather than The Martian.
Yeah. And, like, you know, we've read a lot of science fiction where that's a big problem.
Oh yeah.
And
the Golden Age.
Here, so.
That, and I mean, that's if, you know, if I get, if I got nothing else out of our conversations over Golden Age science fiction that we've read, it would be that, yeah, these guys kind of did have a tendency to ignore women, except for Heinlein, but that's a whole nother bag of angry hissing cats. And so, just to take a brief step backwards for a second, we kind of referenced Mars as potentially being a character. And I thought it'd be worth at least putting 30 seconds of attention into that. So, you know, if a story has to have a protagonist and an antagonist, at least classically, right? Then Mars is the antagonist.
Oh, totally.
Right.
Mars is the antagonist.
Completely.
And I think this is one of those stories where, like, in a lot of survival stories, the setting is really important, and oftentimes, like, the setting kind of becomes its own character just because it's so important. So, Adam mentioned earlier, like, if you're on Earth, if you're in Antarctica, for example, which is one of the most hostile places on Earth, movies and books set there, like, the thing, the setting just becomes its own character because it's trying to kill you, and you have to. So in the case of Mars, which is way more hostile than anywhere on Earth is going to be, Mars does almost kind of take on its own antagonist flavor, constantly trying to kill Mark just by virtue of being inhospitable.
Oh, Mars. Mars is a dick. Possible episode title.
Mars is a dick.
Yeah, after a lot of people... you know, inhospitable, like, just things that we take for granted, like I said earlier, with regards to, you know, air pressure, atmosphere, day length, temperature, the fluctuations in temperatures. It's amazing when you think about it, how much liquid water has shaped our world, literally and not so literally, where, you know, without liquid water, the entire face of the planet would be different. And that's one of the reasons why they study Mars so closely, is because they believe liquid water was there at one point. And there's certainly plenty of evidence to prove that. But without liquid water, the planet is, you know, insane. Lack of a better term. Just the thing that struck me was, I count myself as pretty intelligent, but I think I would have brought, on accident, at least some water outside and then watched it evaporate and then been dumbfounded. For maybe 30 seconds, then, like, oh yeah, there's the atmosphere, no air pressure to keep the water liquid. And, you know, it's just things like that.
And I think every little thing is.
I think that's one of the strengths of the book was, like we said earlier, that Mark's survival had to be deliberate. And a lot of these man versus nature settings that at some point everything fails and they luck out. With rain, or they find food, or something happens. On Mars, there is no chance of rain. There's no chance of food. Everything he had to do, he had to make the choice. Every adventure, every trip that he took, everything that he did, had to be a deliberate choice to survive. Because if he didn't, the place was so inhospitable that it would have killed him within minutes.
Yeah, because
yeah,
on the,
and at least... Oh, go ahead.
I say, yeah, because on the tropical island, when you're bad at making a roof... their diary entries like, oh man, I had a miserable night. I got so wet because the first attempt at making a roof sucked. And this one,
right.
Something went wrong with the roof. He and the airlock got shot 50 feet away.
Yeah. Yeah. But I was going to say, like, even if you're trapped on Antarctica, like, all you have to do is bring snow inside and you have water, so, like, even that's a little better than Mars.
Right.
And that's actually one of the reasons when I was reading it, because I knew they were making a movie, that's one of the reasons I think a movie could be really effective of this book, because Mars is such a powerful setting. If they shoot the movie right, like, just the sheer atmosphere of having this person on Mars could be super powerful. If they get that deserted, just completely hostile feeling to come through in film.
Agreed.
Absolutely.
Agreed. So shall we move on to the themes here?
Yeah, I mean, the themes are pretty obvious, I think. Survival and the power of the human spirit, like you would expect in the sort of story.
That will to survive, both on Mark's part and on the part of, especially his fellow crew members,
right.
I guess.
Yes. Or even just the people on Earth who are pouring billions of dollars into this one thing.
Right.
Like, that's
right.
Something people do, so...
And ingenuity would be part of that, too.
Yeah.
Not to get too big idea on us, on anything, but our greatest strength as a species is our not just our intelligence, but our ability to work together, because one human being is relatively small and relatively weak. But as a group, the bigger our numbers get, we grow in power exponentially. And, you know, we've essentially, we have taken over the world. No other species has ever had success close to, even with millions of years, and in a fraction of the amount of time that dinosaurs are on the planet, we have dominated. And I think that book speaks to that strength, that we are willing to work together when things get hard. We're willing to look out for each other, make big sacrifices just for one person, and use our technological expertise and ingenuity and clever ability to overcome even the most inhospitable environments.
Well, Mark found that very comforting when he finally reestablished contact with NASA, that, you know, if I run into a problem I can't solve on my own, I have an entire organization basically full of geniuses that will be thinking about ways to fix it for me.
Right.
Yeah. Even if sometimes he thought that they were kind of annoying.
Well, yeah, when they were micromanaging things like, here's how you should treat your soil. He's like, botanist, hello. Yeah.
Right.
Get the fuck out of here. But then that's also kind of comforting too, isn't it? Because I was thinking, like, even if you were trapped on Mars for a year and a half with, like, a person that you hated, you would at least have someone with you. And I think people take comfort in that, even when they're really annoyed at other people for being dicks. They're like, well, at least I have someone to call a dick, so that's better than nothing.
You'd look forward to the arguments.
Yeah, I actually want to write a book one day about, like, two immortals, like, the only two immortals on Earth who, like, are just forced to hang out with each other from time to time because they're the only people who can understand each other's situation, but they hate each other.
Right.
So, anyway, it's an interesting idea to me. All right, so, as far as, like, points of interest moments, I don't know if we really talked about this in detail too much, so I guess it's worth bringing up again. I guess we touched on it a little bit, saying, you know, like, in a survival story on Earth, you're always going to, like, luck into something. But as far as this book goes, the author took really careful steps to make sure that there was never anything that happened that was just super-duper coincidence. So, like, nothing really bad ever happened to him that was super-duper coincidence, like, you know, an asteroid didn't land on him and destroy his whole, like, site or anything, but then nothing ever really coincidental happened that was lucky either. He tried to make sure everything good and bad, like, stemmed from a logical place.
Yeah, I mean, I could appreciate that when I was reading it, and then even more so when I got to that author interview at the end of my edition where he explicitly said that was a conscious choice that he made.
Right.
Yeah, I really appreciated that.
I wish I could reference, I couldn't find it early this morning when I was looking through it quickly, but the part how we talked about it before, then the the repeated stress of him going in and out of the airlock put stress on some of the seams of the hab, and there was essentially a blowout that he said, I think in the book, launched him, what, 50 meters?
Yeah, 50.
yeah, something like that.
In the airlock, and he went tumbling for an extra 20, 25 or something like that. And that stemmed from a real issue that would come up because the equipment he was using wasn't designed to be used as much or as frequently as it was. And because he did use it like that, he almost killed himself.
Yeah, or the failure of the supply launch, which was just based on them not quite having the time to do the one little tiny extra check that would have been done if they'd had even, you know, an extra week before they had to launch the thing.
Right.
Yeah, or like, I think one of the things that struck me during the launch was there was a bunch of stuff. He's like, if it had paused for like an extra, you know, like 0.4 of a second, it would have all become solid again. Or if everything had slammed against like all of the other three remaining bolts equally instead of just one bolt, then it would have been fine. Just like all these like tiny, tiny little things that was just like shitty.
Right.
But I liked how he like bothered to actually explain it so that it like seemed reasonable. And the airlock on the hab was like one of my favorite bad things happening. It was like something you just wouldn't even think about, that going out the same entrance time and again is just enough to cause a failure. So
right. It was, I remember that part being one of the first, like, oh shit moments. You know, like we've said before in this podcast, time and time again, and this is Mars, and there's so many considerations that the author and Mark had to take into consideration just simply for him to survive there. Him going out of the airlock, NASA's assigning the system to only do this. Once it exceeds its design expectations or, you know, time to live or whatever, it failed, and it failed catastrophically. And I remember that failure being a huge setback. I think he didn't lose any potatoes, because it turns out potatoes are a relatively durable food source, but he lost a bunch of soil, all the germs in the soil, the microbes in the soil.
He wasn't able to grow any more potatoes right after that.
Yeah, or how about when he shorted out the probe that was his means of communicating?
Yeah.
That was like a tiny little technical detail that became a major plot point, because there was no way to replace that stuff once it was burnt out, and it was the kind of little thing that you could do that probably actually does happen sometimes on like work sites here on Earth. Probably people short something out by placing it against a conductive surface without realizing it. It's not a big deal, because you just run down to the hardware store and grab a new one.
Yeah. It's like, oh, shit. Yeah, I replace it. Or even just, so like I think one of the most common things people run up against in survival stories on Earth is that, like, you know, weather, like, nature can find a way to fuck you over, like, you can never quite master it, and so if there's a giant storm, like, you're just kind of screwed. So I kind of thought that was interesting, that towards the end of this book, when he's finally, like, on his, you know, miles-long journey, whatever it is, to go to the new site, and then he runs into a dust storm, which is, like, very, familiar. It's just a different kind of thing that he's running into.
A Martian spin on an old problem.
Yeah.
Right. And again, to reference, I guess, my military experience, in the Middle East they have what's called shamals, I think. They pronounce these huge dust storms, and it kicks up huge amounts of dust, just miles high walls of dust, and it plays terribly with our equipment, and us. You can't really go outside, visibility is down to zero, and you would think, oh, you just use radar systems, and that's what all that's for. Well, satellites can't see through it, and because of all the particulate in the air, it kind of screws with radar. And it's a big deal. Not that it completely shuts us down, but it hinders us. So a dust storm on Mars, when you're by yourself, away from, you know, riding in a jerry-rigged system all by yourself becomes a huge problem. And that's one of my favorite parts of the book, because they couldn't contact Mark on Earth at that point, and they couldn't track him expressly. And they kind of had to hope that he would figure it out on his own. And he does. And when he figures it out, it's not one, you know, aha moment. It was, you know, these things are happening. What could cause this? Okay, then he kind of comes up with a system, and then he figures it out. And, you know, he does get a little lucky, but it's the sort of luck that I feel that is very realistic.
Our other point of interest, I guess. I'm going to broaden it slightly, but it's because this is, you know, a kind of a near future hard science fiction story. There are aspects of it that we don't currently have an exact working technology for yet, but that seem plausible. So, like, if you're kind of a space exploration fan, then the idea of getting a person on Mars within our lifetime, assuming that we had the will to fund something like that, seems pretty plausible and pretty cool.
Yeah, so like one of the, you know, big, I guess, roadblocks right now to getting to Mars, or just like space exploration in general, is that it takes so much effing time to do it, which is why movies love inventing, you know, like wormholes and stuff, so that you can
right.
get past that issue. Yeah, and that was like actually one of the big issues they ran up against in the book, was like, if we send someone to go get him at this time, it's going to take them this many days to get there. Like, there's no way to speed that up. And so they have to, like, deal with the limits of how fast we can go.
Right. So some of the strengths and weaknesses of the writing itself here. It's definitely a bestseller-y type of book. Has that kind of thriller pacing where things are happening routinely to be dealt with. I guess it turns out, based on some of the reviews Gabs was referencing earlier, that it's a pretty quick and easy and entertaining read if you appreciate the subject matter and the sense of humor.
Yeah, I was surprised that, like, some people found it really, really boring. They just couldn't get past the technical aspect, where I was like, if I ever hit a stretch of pages where I was like, I don't really care about these calculations, then I would just, like, skip it. Because I do think overall, like, it's plotted pretty tightly, so I didn't really find it boring. But I guess if you were not into space, then you would probably just be like, I don't fucking care at all. But then I don't know why you would, like, try to read the book.
Right. That seems like a reasonable question.
So I think I would say to someone, if you're not interested in space travel, don't read this book. And I think it runs into that thing a lot of, like, bestseller-type books that we read run into, which is, like, the story's interesting and the plotting's good, but the character necessarily that interesting.
Right, you just have a... Go ahead.
I was going to say, that was probably the biggest flaw of the book for me, was that the characters, aside from Mark and the handful of people we did mention, and even those people, all sort of ran together. There was no distinguishing
yeah.
features. I think at one point, two of the astronauts on the ship it's revealed that they're dating, I was like, who
yeah.
the hell are those two again? Like, is that
supposed
to be
yeah, like, why
something?
Do they like each other?
Right. Like, all right, whatever. Yeah, that's my biggest, I guess, complaint with the book.
Yeah,
I thought it was pretty significant that, like, a week after I had read the book, I couldn't remember anyone's names except for Mark.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. That being said, I do like the technical space stuff, and I do like this particular flavor of snark, so I enjoyed the book pretty thoroughly.
I have to agree, Ben.
Yeah, I was telling these guys, like, I was actually on a bus ride from New York to Boston when I read this book, and we got stuck in traffic, so the bus ride took longer than it was supposed to, and basically my only form of entertainment was to read The Martian the whole time I was stuck on the bus, with, like, occasional breaks to, you know, like, text Scott and complain. So, like, as far as it went for me, I actually think the setting, like, in which I read this book made it more enjoyable for me. Reading it all in one setting and kind of getting sucked up into that, because there's just nothing else I could. I wonder if I had just read it the way I normally read books, if I would have thought it was as captivating as reading it in one sitting. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I was laughing about that a little bit when we were outlining, because Gabs kept saying that it was a good stuck on a bus book, and I was like, that's a very backhanded compliment.
It is a good stuff. If anyone, like, take this book the next time you travel on a plane or a bus, and if you get delayed, then you'll be like, well, at least I can read the book.
Well, you could kind of say that about some of the other bestsellers we've read, too. Like, something by Dan Brown is not a great book, but if you were stuck on a bus or a plane, you at least wouldn't be bored while you were reading it. You would just be pretending like you're, like, know everything about art and history.
I was on a plane. I got stuck in an airport once for, like, 6 hours by myself, and the only book I had with me was The Three Musketeers, and I quickly found out that is a horrible book to have when you're stranded in the airport, because you're like, I have to think when I read it, it's, like, written kind of difficult, like, I don't really know what's happening, and so, like, I ended up just, like, putting the book away, and I, like, don't even remember what I ended up doing instead. But, like, The Martian, or a Dan Brown book is, like, perfect to have if you're stuck in an airport, because then you're just, like, pissed, and you're like, well, at least this is easy to read and entertaining. Right.
So
if nothing else, yeah.
I was going to say, it's definitely a market. You go to the airport, and they have, you know, Dan Brown, Tom Clancy, who's the other one? Grisham.
James Patterson.
Yeah, that's a... Not that those books can't be entertaining or good, but I always liken those books to, like, a show like The West Wing. Well, if you watch The West Wing enough, you realize that it definitely has its flaws. It's very well made for what it is. And that sounds like a backhanded compliment, but it doesn't compare to a type of fiction or a piece of fiction like, I'm a little biased, but The Wire or... No Country for Old Men, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, well, like, watching, like, The Office as opposed to watching, like, something, yeah, that's really good. I would rather watch, like, shitty romantic comedies for 6 hours while stuck in an airport than, like, a bunch of, like, best Oscar, like, best picture winners, probably.
Right. Something you can start and stop quickly. Something I'm emotionally invested in. Now, I will say that I was a little emotionally invested in The Martian. I did like the character. I like the setting. I'm a big space science fiction fan. I know a lot about NASA and the history of space exploration. I find this stuff very inspiring. And there was parts of the book I was found myself really cheering for Mark. And I actually said out loud to no one in particular, at one point when I was reading, I was like, why am I so excited he's going to live? I know how it ends. like, why the hell am I so excited?
I really wanted him to live, too, though.
Yeah, I did, too, but at the same time, I was never worried that that was not how it was going to end, I think.
Yeah. The author would be total dick. Like, he finally gets on the thing, it launches, goes to, like, grab him off of the probe, he misses, Mark, like, falls into the Martian atmosphere and dies. And you're like, well, thanks for that.
Bad end. I think that's probably an okay moment to put a bow on it with our bad end.
Yeah.
So what are you reading right now?
Go ahead, Adam.
Yeah, I'm reading a book called Countdown to Zero Day. It's about some really nerdy, really technical cybersecurity virus stuff. It's hard to describe. Simply put, it's talking about the first digital weapon. And that's what I want to do when I become a real boy when I get out of the Navy. So reading about it only helps.
And you're typically a nonfiction reader, right? So this is the sort of book you like to read.
Yeah, I'm a big nonfiction reader. If I guess it's a testament to how much I liked The Martian, but if a fiction book doesn't grab me quickly and doesn't hold me, I'm not going to read it. Well, I will power through a nonfiction book. I just think they're so interesting. I can't explain it.
Hey, Tom Hanks agrees with you. He loves nonfiction, so that's a random fact I know about Tom Hanks.
There you go.
That's a good company to keep.
Yeah. So actually, yesterday, I just finished reading Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte, which is a super famous piece of classic lit that I had managed somehow never to read being an English major. And so I just decided, like, you know, fuck it, it's been on my shelf for 6 years. I might as well read it. And it was kind of weird, and I thought all of the characters were horrible people who deserved to die, so it was kind of an interesting read for me. But yeah, that's what I just read.
And there's a significant chance it'll be a future podcast episode, because now I feel like I should power through it while it's still fresh in her mind.
Yeah.
So what I'm reading right now is apparently Wuthering Heights, but what I'm actually reading right now is The Amazing Story of Quantum Mechanics by James Kakalios. That's probably not how that's pronounced, but it's the math-free version of quantum mechanics, and he uses a lot of pulp science fiction from like the 1920s and 30s, around the time period that most of this stuff was actually being discovered, as part of his comparison. And he also has leaned heavily on Doc Manhattan from The Watchmen for certain examples.
Oh, nice.
So it's a pretty fun way to tell the story. All right, so now we've reached the plugs portion of our podcast.
Yes. Adam, is there anything you would like to recommend to people?
Absolutely, there is. If you knew me in college, then you probably knew my girlfriend at the time, Megan Kincaid. She wrote a book, and I'm very proud of her, and I'm a little biased, but the book is called Undead Rising, Decide Your Destiny, by M.E. Kincaid. You can find it on Amazon.com. By the paperback, and I'm pretty sure there's a Kindle edition. It's a choose-your-own-adventure book, and it's the first one I've read since maybe I was 10 years old, or maybe 11. Either way, it's full of good humor, and it has a really interesting twist that I have not seen in a book before, honestly, and I really enjoyed it. If you could pick it up and support an ex-Farker, that would be greatly appreciated.
By the way, Fark is the dorm we used to live in.
Oh, yeah. Not the website with, like, millions of followers at one point, yeah. Also, since I believe our primary podcast-related interactions have happened via Twitter up to this point, what's your Twitter handle?
Mine?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's @Adam_Milton. It's both boring
there,
Twitter handle.
There you go. So if anyone wants to pull in one more person from the novel idea circle, @Adam_Milton. Now, if you would like to speak to us directly, and we will be happy to relay any comments to Adam if you want to do it through the official feed, you can leave a comment on our website at novelideaspodcast.com.
Yeah, you can also tweet us @NovelIdeasPod, or you can tweet me personally @ClassicSumUp.
Yep, you can find us on iTunes, and I guess we still haven't officially talked about killing the email address, but I think we're just going to kill the email address.
Yeah, we do not check the email, guys. Sorry about that. And then just kind of an interesting additional plug. If anyone listening has not yet checked out my new online magazine, Minerva, you can find that at minervamag.com. It's dedicated to basically all things geek, kind of from a woman's perspective or focusing on some women's things. But we're not super biased. We like other stuff too. And the exciting part about that is novel ideas might possibly become part of the Minerva Magazine podcast feed. So we might soon be podcasting to you officially sponsored by Minerva. which is exciting.
That is exciting.
And we have a lot of other fun podcasts on the website too, on Minerva, if you want to check those out.
And
so,
depending on whether or not I can get my act in gear, it's possible that 2/3 of the people on this episode will be writing for Minerva occasionally as well. So I think that is it for this time. Next time,
yep.
I'm not sure what will be airing. I actually think that probably I'm going to bump this episode up in the queue. So there's a good chance that the next one you hear will actually be about Sherlock Holmes.
Sherlock.
And I don't know, maybe Wuthering Heights, we'll see. But that should do it. That's all for this time, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye-bye.